Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Francine Matthews, who reads from and discusses her thriller, The Alibi Club, published by Bantam. In the weeks to come, we have James McGreevy, Sina Jeter-Nasland, T.A. Barron, Barack Obama, Richard Ford, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. Good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for your support. Francine Matthews attended Princeton University, where she learned to write news stories for the Daily Princetonian, which led to part-time jobs as journalist for both the Miami Herald and the San Jose Mercury News. And while her major was European history, she was most affected by the Literature of Fact course she took, which was taught by John McPhee. Francine earned her master's at Stanford and later joined the CIA, where she served as an intelligence analyst. She wrote her first book in 1992 and left the CIA a year later. Her double life as a writing agent must have been good training for her full-time career as a double writer, because she writes both as Francine Matthews and Stephanie Barron. We're delighted that Francine is with us tonight to present her latest book, The Alibi Club. Would you please join me in welcoming Francine back to the Tattered Cover?
Thank you, Charles. You know, someone asked me earlier today if I was nervous. And I said, well, no, not really, but I first signed at the Tattered Cover when I was expecting my son, Sam. I think I was 5 months pregnant, and of course he's now 5'5", and affectionately known as Kid Shogun at our house. So a lot of time has passed, and what's been interesting for me is to reflect over the past 12 years on how many of you have shown up for me at these nights. And I am so grateful for that, and you have my deepest thanks. Usually when I'm talking about writing, I get one question beyond all others, and that is, where do you get your ideas? There are so many people who write who profess to hate that question. They think it's banal. I think it's the question. And it's the one I love to answer, because part of what compels me as I sit and write is the way that various threads of stories spring up out of nowhere, almost as if they're meant, and come together into a complex web that becomes the story. That was true more than ever of The Alibi Club, and I want to talk about the book and where it came from, but I am going to read tonight. I'm reading a section that's a little bit longer than I normally would subject people to, but I love it. And the whole point of this section is in the final words, so I have to ask you to submit and bear with me. Prologue, March 12, 1940. There were nine people waiting in the stuffy room that faced the aerodrome's tarmac. 10 if you counted the sleeping child swaddled in a blanket in the Italian girl's arms. 3 women, 6 men, several nationalities, and the brazen churn of propellers beyond the frosted window. Each of the waiting passengers was desperate enough to leave Oslo in the dead of night and dead of winter, so the air hummed with suppressed violence and restlessness and incipient hysteria. No one spoke. Jacques Allier had his back to the wall nearest the door, an evening newspaper grasped in one gloved hand, the other thrust in his pocket. The unheated room was freezing, but his skin was beaded with sweat and his hidden fingers clutched a gun. The clock read 3 minutes until midnight. The plane would leave at 12:07. Allier's passport had been taken 10 minutes ago and not returned. The man named Dimars, who had all his luggage, was inexplicably missing from the aerodrome, and this was only one of the factors contributing to Allier's sweat. He hated to fly. When he'd undertaken this operation, he'd asked for a submarine out of Brest, a destroyer from Turn's book. He'd gotten an 8-seater with ice on its wings and no guns to speak of. He was praying he'd be allowed to board, although Allier was one of those who could not believe in God, not now. He was a spare, bland-faced man in the good cloth coat and spectacles of a banker, mid-40s, perhaps, clearly European, but shockingly unmilitary for the times. His eyes drifted away from the damning clock. The man Demars was still missing, and roved indifferently over the faces of his fellow passengers. Two men arguing politics in Dutch. A gawky boy in his teens, his looks feverish, and his hands drumming nervously against the arm of his chair, fingers spilling cigarette ash onto the linoleum floor. A gray-haired woman stolidly eating pickled herring from a waxed paper box furnished by an Oslo shop. None of them spoke, none made eye contact. Only the tall, burly, blonde fellow in the impeccable camel's hair coat was staring openly, a slight smile curving his lips, at the Italian girl with the sleeping child. And who could blame him, Allier thought irritably. She was exquisite, with her fur collar grazing her faintly flushed cheek, her dark knot of hair shining beneath the arc of her hat. Her fingers were gloved in ostrich skin. The frail hunch of her shoulders might reflect the penetrating cold, or the solicitude that kept her bent, Madonna-like, over the face of her infant. Was she even 20? Her passport and ticket lay on the hard wooden bench beside her. Like Allier, she was bound for Amsterdam in the dead of night. "Turn back," he urged. "Go north, go west, go anywhere but home." He had caught one glimpse of her mouth, curved like a G-clef, and her eyes disconcertingly blue in an olive-skinned face. The blonde hero opposite had glimpsed them too. "Madam," the man said gently in Italian, "you look chilled to the bone. Perhaps a cigarette, if I were to light it for you?" The girl ignored him, failing to so much as lift her head. Allier exulted in this, in the snub offered the blonde hero, who might, from his looks, have been Norwegian, or even English, but who Allier knew now was German, a broad-shouldered, perfect German in civilian dress, lounging in the very aerodrome where he, Allier, had elected to escape. This could not be coincidence. This was part of a plan. The fact of the German presence meant that Allier was already a dead man. Demars and the luggage would not be coming. He tossed the folded newspaper into a waste bin, then moved casually toward the door leading out to the plains. One of them bound for Perth, the other for Amsterdam. The propellers whined in the cold, the pilots worried about ice. It was possible that they would all be told to go home, to try again tomorrow. And for Allier there would be the certainty of an armed escort at some point along his route back to the French legation, a sudden, flurried movement into an enemy car, a bullet in the temple, after how many agonizing hours of interrogation. He continued to stare through the waiting room window, his gloved hands clasped behind his back, conscious of movement, some kind of rank closing behind. It was barely 2 weeks since he'd vaulted up the marble steps of the armament ministry and accepted the fake passport in his mother's maiden name, Freis. He was Michel Freis of Salzburg, aged 41, a banker with no interest in this phony war between France and the Germans that had been going on for 7 months now without a shot fired. That night, he'd taken the last train across the border, bound for Amsterdam, and then, by slow degrees, traveled north to Stockholm, and finally Oslo. There were 5 days of negotiation in a tiny snowbound town near the Telemark Mountains, ponderous dinners and pledges of eternal friendship and risky flourishes of the French flag. Oblique councils in the legation, none of the usual diplomats in on the secret, and the lights burning all night in the German intelligence pavilion across the garden wall. "You're famous," the French ambassador assured him with a twisted smile. "Everybody wants to talk to you. Our people caught this the day you left Paris." It was a decoded German radio transmission, he carelessly handed Allier. "At any price, intercept a suspect Frenchman traveling under the name of Freiss." What the ambassador hadn't bothered to point out was that Allier had been betrayed before he'd boarded that night train to Amsterdam. "Mr. Freiss," said a voice at his elbow. He turned, caught the untroubled face of Norwegian border control, a woman neatly uniformed. Her clipped hair, so fair it might almost be white. She was offering him a bunch of papers, but he ignored her extended hand. The police sirens had pulled up to the aerodrome door. In a matter of seconds, the door would burst open, a clutch of men tripping over themselves in their haste to seize him. He might have time to take one of them down, the big German, perhaps, but there were these women, that child in the Madonna's arms. "Your passport and ticket for Amsterdam," Border Control persisted. "Everything's in order. You may proceed to the tarmac." He glanced over her head and met the German's eyes. The man was still smiling faintly, the same indulgent look he'd turned on the young Italian princess who was rising now from her seat, magnificent and indifferent. "He's let me run all this way so he could follow my trail," Allier thought. "I'll lead him no further." He took his passport and ticket from the woman's hand and without a word held the door wide. The Italian girl flicked him one glance from her resting blue eyes as she passed. Not even this, Allier thought, was comfort before dying. Then he and the blonde hero followed her into the cold. There was confusion about the planes. A huge black Daimler had driven straight onto the tarmac and thrust itself between them. A man was running distractedly beneath the wings, shouting inaudibly over the clutter of the engines and barely avoiding the propellers. His driver pulled an astonishing number of suitcases from the idling car. The police and their sirens were silent now beyond the runway gates. It was the Daimler they had escorted through the streets of Oslo, wailing right up to the Amsterdam flight. Allier felt his face flush with heat and his hands clench. This is what hope feels like, terror and a clenched fist. He recognized the dapper, black-haired figure pirouetting beneath the fuselage. He recognized the suitcases. Dimar's driver was loading them even now into the belly of the Perth plane. Allier counted them as best he could across the distance and darkness. 13, he thought. Please God, let there be 13. Dimar's collided headlong with the German. Whiskey fumes and cigar smoke wafted through the frigid night air. "Pardon, most esteemed sir," he spoke Norwegian, and he clutched the German's sleeve like a spoiled child. "Which of these is the Amsterdam plane? Have I missed it? I must at all costs make the Amsterdam plane." They argued the destination of both flights, the Daimler's right to park in the middle of the tarmac, the abuse of police escort, the advisability of arriving on time. Allier kept walking. He didn't look back. The Italian girl boarded the Amsterdam plane, with a grimace on her face, the saintly infant now screaming in her arms. Allier's ticket fluttered to the ground. He pulled a second one, stamped for Perth, from his breast pocket. As the Amsterdam pilot taxied toward his takeoff, Allier caught a glimpse of the blonde German under the tarmac lights, hatless, his coat flying back like wings, running hopelessly after the wrong plane. Fog diverted them, as was expected. They landed near dawn in a town Allier had never heard of, somewhere on the east coast of Scotland. A small field, quite deserted, the waiting room windows blacked out with painted canvas. The pilot gave him tea. From politeness, he tried to drink it. "Did you hear?" the man asked him. "The Germans shot down that plane, the one bound for Amsterdam last night. Allier thought of the young Italian girl, the two men arguing in Dutch, the child that would have been wailing, certainly, as the flames bloomed in the cockpit and the frantic pilot beat them back, the long, tight fall into the North Sea, implacable as a destroyer's hull. He set down the tea. "What have you got in all those suitcases?" the pilot asked curiously. "The crown jewels of Norway." Allier glanced at the man. The truth was a breach of security, but the pilot would never believe him anyway. "Water," he replied. So why would anyone risk his life for water? Well, I suppose if a war were about thirst, it would make sense. But this was a particular type of water. It was heavy water. Jacques Allier was a banker. He was a real person. And he was sent north 3 weeks before Norway fell to the Germans to get the world's stockpile of heavy water out of Norway and into France. There's a lot of ways to look at the whole German advance through Europe in 1939 and 40, and one of the more interesting, is to look at the way they were assembling the materials for an atomic bomb. They took Czechoslovakia first, which had Europe's only source of uranium, and then they swung north and they took Norway. It fell 3 weeks after Allier got out, in April of 1940, and in May they launched the offensive against France. And France was where a man named Fred Joliot lived in Paris. He was married to Marie Curie's son-in-law. He was a physicist, and he had, in 1939, a plan for an atomic bomb. He was one of the few people who actually thought he knew how it would work. He also had the only cyclotron in Europe. And the Germans knew this, and so they were systematically compiling what they needed to build an atomic bomb. He saw it coming, and in the few weeks left before Paris fell, he sort of assembled a team of amateurs to get everything he had out, including his personnel, whom he cared about and who he figured would be victims if they were captured. I stumbled on this story when I started reading about atomic physics, which I was doing last year, because I realized suddenly that I knew very little about how the bomb had been built in the 1940s in this country. And what fascinated me about the story is that it showed up over and over in a footnote. It had never really merited a telling of its own. I think there are a number of reasons for this. Fred Joliot Curie, stayed behind in Paris after he did, in fact, get everything out of the city. And he became a member of the resistance. And he started building bombs in his lab in the Sorbonne. But he joined the resistance within France, which was communist. And so by the end of the war, he was sort of viewed with disfavor by the world physics community, even though he was a Nobel laureate and an extraordinary mind. And by 1956, he died of leukemia, which most of the Curies seemed to do. So his story sort of was obscured, and it was obscured in part by the Manhattan Project. One of the things that I love to write about is the way in which the victors present history. And in this story, we built the bomb. So the fact that Fred Joliot Curie had a plan for it in 39 is really irrelevant. But when I read his story, it struck me as an extraordinary chase. And one of the more compelling aspects of it was the fact that the people he assembled were from out of nowhere. There were some Americans at the embassy, there were a lot of Brits, and in my book there's a couple of women. I had been writing for years about terrorism, and to write about terrorism is to live with the monster. It becomes very depressing to write about terrorism. And when you write, you live mentally for the better part of your days elsewhere. So if you're living with terrorism, you live in a very grim landscape, and it was one which I grew extremely tired of. I found it very wearing. And I started looking at the world I'm living in right now and thinking about the very normal people who have to grapple with children being away in Iraq, with the potentiality of loss. And I started to ask myself how women, normal women, from different walks of life, grapple with the kind of disorder that turns their lives upside down. And I thought about Paris and the ways in which the Germans completely subverted the order of that city. So I chose as three women in this story of Fred Curie, an American woman who's a model for Chanel, Sally King, a British woman who single-handedly is running a vineyard in Bordeaux, where most of the people got out of France when they finally did get out, and then Memphis Jones, who is modeled on Josephine Baker, African-American jazz singer who knows the club scene of Paris. Very different lives, and they end up having to work together to survive, which is really the heart of the story. And finally, the final thread that came into all of this is again how the victors write history. We love in this country to say that this was the good war. I grew up with World War II because my parents were the World War II generation. My father was a pilot in the Army Air Corps, and one of his jobs was to fly Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt. So for me, these people and these stories were part of my family history. But when you look deeper and you look at Paris 1940, that was a time when we weren't in the war. We were neutral. When I looked at the Hydro Norsk facility that made heavy water in Norway, there were two principal shareholders of that firm. One was Jacques Allier's bank, and the other was a German company called IG Farben Industry. It's reorganized now as BASF. But it went on in the war to create Zyklon B at Auschwitz, major German chemical firm. And it was represented worldwide in its business dealings by a New York law firm, Sullivan and Cromwell. Sullivan and Cromwell was run by a man named John Foster Dulles, who became Eisenhower's Secretary of State. Dulles Airport's named after him. It also had Alan Dulles, who ran the CIA for 10 years. I used to walk by Alan Dulles' portrait in the hallway at the CIA, and you know, a lot of the portraits, they have a portrait of every director on the wall, and most of them really are dull, very boring. Alan's just leaps out at you, because the man was a Class A rogue. He was a womanizer. He was a schemer. He was utterly charming, totally manipulative personality. And he and his brother came to represent for me the divided face of America in 1940. John Foster Dulles was the wealthiest lawyer in the world in 1940. He was a dear friend of Charles Lindbergh's, and he was an America firster. He had cultivated German clients after World War I to the point where he was the last New York firm to close in Berlin as Hitler began his rise. And he had to be forced to do it by his partners because Sullivan and Cromwell was also the first white shoe New York law firm to have a significant representation of Jewish partners. And they were appalled that they were still in Berlin. He finally closed, partly because his brother forced him in a public meeting to submit. And Alan Dulles was a friend of Roosevelt's, and he quit Sullivan and Cromwell to form the OSS. He was the last American over the French-Swiss border before it closed, and he used the unemployed lawyers of Sullivan and Cromwell throughout Europe as the basis of his OSS network inside occupied France. They fought this out in op-ed pieces in the New York Times, which is where gentlemen fought their wars in 1940. But I found their responses to world crisis fascinating. And to me, in that family dispute over the dinner table, is the real history. It's not just the simple version we get growing up. So it's a complex book. It was a joy to write. Partly because when you write to do the research. And I got to read some remarkable stuff about growing vines in Bordeaux, about Chanel and her life and about international law at the time of war. So I hope that you could get half as much fun out of the book as I did writing it. For me, the most interesting part of these nights is the questions I get and the way that we can talk about the ideas. So I'd love to hear anything that anyone has to ask. Yes. The question was, do I ever find it difficult to write a Jane Austen mystery, which has a very different voice from my thrillers? And if I'm writing them simultaneously, how I switch gears. I sort of had to grapple with that issue last summer because I turned in The Alibi Club in July and I turned in the next Jane Austen in August. That will be out in Thanksgiving. For those of you who aren't familiar with my work, I write a series of 9 books at this point in which Jane Austen is the detective, and they're set in 1810 England, and they're very different in tone. A thriller, by its very nature, is generally written in the third person, and it has a multiple cast of characters. It has several different plot lines, and the challenge in writing that kind of a book is choreography. It's all about plot and pacing, because you can't sacrifice the pace of the book to your interest in the subplots, which is very tempting to do. And a lot of what I write ends up on the floor as a result, because I have to be ruthless. I had a college roommate who used to say about our closet, "Be ruthless, Franny," when I was going through to give out to Goodwill. And that phrase has stayed with me forever, because you have to be ruthless about everything in life, and your own children especially, and my books are my children. So I end up doing a lot more organizational balancing with the thrillers. The Jane books are written in the first person, and as a result, they're very linear. You experience the plot of the novel through Jane's eyes, and it's as she progresses through her day. They're much simpler to write. And they only take me about 8 weeks. So when I switch gears to do them, they get done. I would never attempt to write the books simultaneously in the sense of in the same day. That's not possible. Len just asked me, what's happening to the movie rights for the cutout? That was an interesting little line in the entire cover publicity, Charles. The movie rights to the cutout sold in the year 2000, and it will never be made. And I'm not sure why it surfaced in that blurb. I was a little shocked. It won't be made, I think, because of 9/11. It was going into production when the World Trade Center fell, and there was a sort of chill over exploiting terrorism for entertainment that lasted for about a year, and then, of course, it proliferated. There was this bloom of entertainment pivoting on terrorism. But that movie fell victim to that. It is what we used to say in the CIA, OBE'd, which means overtaken by events. It's now obsolete due to time. So, yes. I got interested in this story when I sat in the audience of Copenhagen, which is Michael Frayn's play. It's a phenomenal play. The question, by the way, was, what did I learn in my research about the race between the Americans and the Germans to develop the bomb? Copenhagen is, if you get a chance to see it anywhere, do. It's a brilliant play, but it's about a meeting between Werner Heisenberg, who was Hitler's architect for the atomic bomb, and Niels Bohr, who was his father figure and his mentor and a man he loved. And he had worked with him for 20 years. He'd lived with his family. He'd gone through loss with Bohr. And Bohr, at the time that Heisenberg traveled to Copenhagen to talk to him, was essentially under house arrest. Copenhagen was occupied by Heisenberg's Germany. And Bohr was half Jewish. And nobody knows what Heisenberg went to Copenhagen to say to Bohr. Whether he asked him to help him build the bomb because he couldn't do it, or whether he asked him not to build the bomb for us because he was terrified it would be used on himself in Germany. And Heisenberg lived on into the 70s, and he never explained the conversation. But what people do know is that the two men broke absolutely after that, and their great relationship was at an end. And Bohr did escape Copenhagen, and he did join the Manhattan Project, and he did help us build the bomb. There's a lot of question as to whether Heisenberg deliberately chose to spin out his research and fail and there are some who believe that that is what he did throughout the war. There are others who believe he was incapable of doing it. And the ironic truth is that Hitler, by banning all occupation by Jewish academics in Germany from the 1930s on, forced the very people who could have developed a bomb for him out of the country. And they all ended up elsewhere in the world and eventually in the U.S. or England. So in a sense, it was never going to happen in Germany. And there's a very good reason why it happened elsewhere. If anybody's interested in this topic, the book that lays it out beautifully is called Heisenberg's War, and it's by Thomas Powers, and it's the basis for the play Copenhagen. Oh, Mario, you said you had questions. The question is, how did I get my agent? I'm going to embarrass my father-in-law now. I wrote my first book. I'm going to embarrass a number of people. I wrote my first book on a dare from my husband. I told him that I hated working in an office, that I wasn't born for this, that I should be able to work for a few hours a day and then garden or needlepoint or cook or raise my children, that work should not consume every hour of my day. And my beloved Mark said, "Are you a princess?" "You're paid to think. Do you know how few people in America can say that? You should be down on your knees thanking God for that job." So I said, "What I really want to do is write. I want to write at home and manage my own work and not wear stockings." And he said, "You know, that's a pipe dream. And you're not going to quit your job and write, because you'll wake up in 12 years and you'll have 3 kids and 5 unfinished novels in the closet, and it'll be awful for you." Which turned out to be the wisest thing anyone has ever said to me. So we had no children at that point. He traveled a lot. I couldn't take my work home. So I wrote at night. And I wrote my first book my last year at the agency. And my then mother-in-law, who passed away in the year 2000, had been editor of the Christian Science Monitor. And she sat on the AP board and the board of the Boston Globe and Pulitzer board and a variety of places. And she had blurbed a book for an agent that had been written by a journalist she'd employed at one point. So she took my manuscript and, without telling me, mailed it to this agent. And then she sent me a little letter. It was a draft copy of the letter that she'd written to him. And she said, "Call him," on the bottom. And I had been diligently reading guides to submission for literary agents, and I knew that you never send them an entire manuscript, ever. They don't want an entire, you know, they want a letter, and then they want the first 10 pages, and then they call you 3 months later, and they'll say, "Send me 25 more," and, you know. It's this dance that you go through. So I never called him because I was mortified. And in her letter, she'd said, "Here's my daughter-in-law's book. Maybe you can tell her how to make it better." So it was really... So a month later, I came home, and there was a message on my machine from this agent asking me to come meet with him. And I thought, "Oh, God, he's doing this for Kay. This is so embarrassing." And in fact, he wanted the book. And the reason he wanted the book, this is vital to know if you're a writer, because they'll tell you it's about the merits of the book. It's not. He liked the book because it was set on Nantucket and he'd grown up in Massachusetts. One of the characters was a cranberry farmer and he'd worked for Ocean Spray in high school. And another character was named Rafe. His name is Rafe. He said, "I'm going to send this to Knopf." I said, "Rafe, this is not a Knopf book." And guess what? Knopf said that too. But he's been my agent ever since. And, you know, I love him dearly. So it's a good story. There are other people who've been embezzled by agents and people who go through agents like Kleenex, and it can be ugly, so it really does vary. But if you are looking for an agent, what can be helpful is to go to the guides and look who represents people you respect as a writer, people who have been published well, which can mean through reputable houses that actually promote their work. That's harder and harder to find, but it does exist. And then start submitting to them along with their guidelines. Don't send 500 pages. Yes, sir. Question is, do I ever sense that there are enough words in the world? I usually feel that way when I'm overloaded and I'm in public and it's really loud. Yes, I do think that there are enough words in the world then. But I don't think that there is ever enough storytelling. You know, man has been described as the storytelling animal. And I look at my own children who are mesmerized by stories, who need stories to live on a daily basis for myriad reasons. I think what changes is the format, and we no longer paint caves and we no longer inscribe papyrus. And someday we may no longer have books, although it really is sacrilege to say that in this place. But we will always have stories. And that is part of our genes, I think. And I love being able to tell them. Yes. The question is, what books am I reading, or what are the favorites I've read in the past year? I have Nora Ephron's... I feel so bad about my neck on my closet floor because I love her. And she's so... right. And I'm aging. And I'm about to feel bad about my neck. I'm reading Waterland by Graham Swift for my book group. I have a wonderful book group. I'm also reading Mysteries for a panel I'm moderating at a conference this coming weekend. And one of them is written by the wife of the British ambassador to the United States, Elizabeth Ironsides. It's called Death in the Garden, and it is a wonderful 1920s and contemporary look at England. So I recommend that. We just finished Cloud Atlas by David Mitchell, which is probably the most extraordinary book I've read in a decade. And I have to say that the most compelling thriller I read in the past year was Kill Me by Stephen White. It hits everybody where they live. Any other questions? Well, thank you. You've been a wonderful audience. I appreciate you coming out on a Thursday night.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for James McGreevy, Sina Jeter-Naslin, T.A. Barron, Barack Obama, Richard Ford, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on September 21st, 2006.